Thanks for joining me here at the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Appreciate your time and your attention. Hopefully I'll deliver something that is worthy of your attention. That's the goal here, where we try to keep it concise, try to keep it relevant and authentic. And I hope you agree and we'll rate and review accordingly. Excellent, excellent guest waiting in the wings right now. We're talking all things Spaniels, in particular Cocker Spaniels. So if you have questions, you're just curious, thinking about maybe getting one, we'll cover all of that, plus some suggestions on public access hunting, wild bird hunting, that sort of thing. Cover a little bit on electronic collars while we're talking to our guest as well. All things considered, it should be a really interesting and informative program. In addition to all that, of course, a little bit of a kind of a catch-up here. Thank you, David Gilbertson, and everybody at the Redmond Rod and Gun Club for their hosting me at a recent event where I guess my job was just to motivate new shooters, get people to bring somebody new out there, and we had a great time doing it. What an incredible Twisted Tree Sporting Clays course they have out there, all volunteers. If you're ever in Central Oregon, check them out. As I've said before, dogs are the best ambassadors for making a new hunter, but if you can't get a dog and a new potential hunter out in the field, well, take them shooting. It's a close second. It's fun. It's social. It's easy to get to in most cases, and that might be just the ticket right there. All right. Well, we're down to the wire on our training. How about you and your dog? We're still working on that last 10% on Flick's field performance. Dave Carty, Gun Dog magazine columnist, brought that up a couple weeks ago. In fact, I'll be talking to Dave about that in more detail very soon on the Upland Nation podcast. What's your goal for the last few weeks? Yeah, it's a little late for most. In fact, that was the kind of the running joke in the music business when I was back there. You know, you get on stage or you're basically waiting in the green room or in the wing somewhere, and hey, man, it's too late. If you haven't got it now, you never will. So may as well make the most of it. That's how I've looked at hunting tests for a long time as well. Seems to keep me sane, at least, if nothing else, and keeps the dogs happy, and that's really all that matters, isn't it? But how about you and your hopes? You know, every week in the Weekend Essentials Upland Nation newsletter, I ask a question or a multiple-choice question, a poll, if you will, and last week's was revealing in a lot of ways. I asked, what are your hopes for this hunting season? Gave a few choices, and the number one hope is to go on more hunting trips. Number two on the list, finding new places to hunt. And then equal third place finishes for better dog work. Funny how that goes. And then hunting more often with friends and family. Well, I've got suggestions for all of that. You might want to mark your favorites page is with findbirdhuntingspots.com. That's where you'll find all of that and more, including some new gear reviews and buyer's guides and things like that that seem to be resonating with a lot of folks, wild bird hunters in particular. We're talking about strap vests, for example, socks and all sorts of other things like that, and what's in my vest. So take a look at that, findbirdhuntingspots.com. And while you're on the World Wide Web, visit sageandbreaker.com. They have the gun care products that are crafted at the highest caliber. Fred Bohm, friend of mine, great writer and photographer in his own right. You can see a lot of his work on his Facebook page, Sage and Breaker. And you can also learn a whole lot about gun care, how to clean, how to take care of your guns, and take a look at all of their products. Sign up for the mailing list, free shipping always, and the mailing list was where you're going to get advance notice on all the new stuff coming down the pike. And Dogtra.com, speaking of new stuff, it's kind of my go-to collar, the T&B Dual Dogtra Training Collar. They've got all sorts of other things over there, too, depending on your budget and your needs. It's all at Dogtra.com. Well, I promised you a great show with maybe some eye-opening opportunities for you and me. A lot of people wanted me to talk about spaniels in general, but also about Cocker Spaniels in particular. I'm in love with the breed. If you watch the TV show, every once in a while you'll see them working in tandem with a pointing breed of one sort or another. I like to think I was in on the beginning of that stuff quite a while back, but you know, I know it's been around for a long time, so it's a pleasure to bring to the podcast for the very first time a name that you might recognize. He's a columnist for Gun Dog Magazine. He does seminars. He founded Pond View Kennels. Gosh, Jerry Ray Cascio, what haven't you done in that world?
Made money.
Yeah, I feel your pain there.
All for the love of the game.
Yeah, so what is the game for you?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, so what is the game for you, Jerry Ray Cascio?
The game for me now, I started out in 1967 training springers and cockers and some labs. Done that. All that till about maybe 85, then I sold Pond View Kennels. I really found out the last part of my career with spaniels, I love teaching more than competing. I was very fortunate and lucky to win a couple of nationals. It's a lot of work and a lot of focus, and seminars I enjoy a lot more. I enjoy the teaching. I think I do it quite well. And that's where I'm kind of at now in my life, more or less enjoying life and not having to go out and clean kennels at 5 o'clock in the morning and answer all kinds of telephone calls. Why didn't I win the field trial? And blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, I can relate to all of that as a former, you know, bona fide teacher, and then just coming off a few other opportunities much like that. Amen to all of that. You get any time to go hunting?
Yeah, right, exactly. And enjoy life. I enjoy fishing now, and I do some fishing, and I do some consultant work for Orvis, so I get free lessons and rods and stuff, and guess what? I'm not any better now than I was before. But I look good. And the good thing about fishing is you catch a fish, you can let it go. You know, you shoot a pheasant or a pigeon or something, it's dead. So I guess I'm getting old.
Yeah, well, I would say you're getting wise. And boy, if there was such a thing as catch and release hunting on birds, boy, I'd be there in a minute as well. Save me a couple hours at the end of the day, too. You know, you mentioned something that I'd forgotten about that I would love to get a little bit of inside information on. Tell us what you did or are doing with Orvis these days, because a lot of us have been to or are considering an Orvis lodge visit or something, buying gear, whatever. Tell us about your work with them.
Yeah. Well, most of my work, of course, is with the dogs. And we used to have a kennel program, and I used to go down also to the lodges, Orvis lodges, and check on their dogs, make sure they were what we are advertising they are. And I, too, got started with a lot of our plantations in Georgia and Florida, working the cockers with the pointing dogs instead of the Labradors. The cockers got a lot more done. They did a lot of retrieving, and they did it well. I'm sorry, folks, but I think the cockers do a much better job than the Labradors. And saying that, the dogs started taking off down in Georgia, the cockers. And now, as you said, you'll see a lot of plantations and stuff now using the cockers. They can get underneath that cover. And I always say the old gents that shoot quail that I ran into, they all had side-by-sides, and it was more important that they retrieved the birds than shot another 20. Sad to say those days, I think, are disappearing, but that's a subject we'll get into sometime, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a never-ending battle, that's for sure. But I remember first being acquainted with the idea of cockers with pointers here in the West, and I thought we were pioneers for a while. Then I went back and made a few shows in Florida and saw what was probably a program that was in its prime at the time. And one of the fascinating things one of the guides told me about the reason for Cocker Spaniels versus, let's just call a Labrador for flushing, the flushing breed, those cockers can get really low, like you said, into some of those palmettos. And when they get that low, number one, they're not having to hammer their way through the brush. They're going under it. And number two, the birds are more likely to go up higher rather than out the other side. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I had another experience working for Talbot Radcliffe over in Wales. He was the guru with springers, and he always taught me that when a spaniel flushes a bird, it gets up higher and a lot safer shot and everything. If you go through the line with beaters and stuff like that, they get up the birds, but a lot lower. You know, when a dog is flushing a bird, you'll see it go up almost straight up and high, you know, and more sporting, you know.
Yeah, and safer as well. In fact, we had a discussion on Saturday during a training morning where there was a certain lodge operation where safety was a little bit less than a primary concern, and if it hadn't been for their use of Cocker Spaniels, there'd be a lot more bad news coming out of that location. So tell me, what moved you completely, what I'm going to call completely, over to field-bred cockers? How'd you make that decision?
My grandfather was quite famous. He had American cockers, and that's what I grew up with. And he won Best in Show in Madison Square Garden 2 years with a black cocker called My Own Brucie. And he really believed form should equal function. And he had a lot of dual champions, which you don't see much of anymore. So I was brought up with American cockers. I got to be honest, my sister-in-law has a good line going, but there's not too many good American cockers out there. And because of all the inbreeding and stuff like that, they have temperament problems and so on. So I got into the cockers. And let me tell you one thing, I've trained 10 times more springers than cockers, and I can train a springer a lot quicker than a cocker.
Why is that?
My good friend Ian Openshaw over in England always said, well, I'm sure, Ray, these cockers got a little terrier in them. You know, when you see their tails going up. And, you know, I remember I have a client coming up, and I'm bragging about this little cocker and this and that. I can't wait till you come up and see him. Bah, bah, bah. Don't you know, we shoot a bird, it goes in the woods, the dog's not coming back. What's he doing, having trouble? And you go over there, and he's digging a hole and burying it. And this is a dog that I've had for 3 or 4 months, and he's trained, you know. And I always said that the terrier comes out once in a while.
Well, you know, that's not all that comes out. The running joke among the guys on my TV crew is, at some point when we're in the field with cockers for any reason, one of the camera guys will get 30 paces away from the dog handler, and all we do is stand by because one of those cockers is going to go full bore and jump right into that guy's arms as if he was being rescued from the sinking of the Titanic.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what is it about those? Maybe it's the terrier in them. I don't know. Why is there so much joy there?
I just think that's part of them. They're so happy doing their work. I always call them hummingbirds on crack. You know, they were just busy as busy can be. And here in the Northeast, shooting woodcock and grouse, which I must say I haven't shot many. I shot at a lot, but they're so exciting to watch. You know, and they're just hammed. And when I used to do field trials and stuff, I always dressed properly from the old days.
Yeah.
And I didn't want a dog jumping up on me. I'm sorry. It was close. And funny, the fellow that I work now with a lot with Danny Lesson, and we're just doing an article for Gun Dog on cockers and hunting grouse and woodcock. And so we're taking some pictures and this and that. All of a sudden, and I call him Pretty Boy Danny, this cocker ends up in his arms for no reason at all. And it's cute unless they're in your arms, I think, you know?
Yeah, I think so. You know, way back in the day, Richard Walters, in his earliest book, he said something like, it's going to happen, just get used to it. And this is back when, you know, casual clothing, you know, he was kind of a Madison Avenue type. His casual clothing was a sport coat and a pipe, of course. But I think that just comes with the territory.
I spent some time with, we're very fortunate with Richard Walters. He came up and trained with me a lot.
Quite a guy. Tell me a story about a guy that we all know of, and many still follow a lot of his methods.
Okay. I think his books are some of the best I've read. As a dog trainer, I think he was below par.
Yeah.
I loved him, don't get me wrong. But he had a way about him that he was different, and, you know, people drew towards him. He came to Meshomic a lot with the tower shoots, and he'd always have a crowd around him. So he said, Ray, I want to do a story. Can I come up and spend a week with you? I said, oh, great. What an honor, you know. So we spent a week together, and after about the third day, I wanted to shoot him. So he said, I got to do a seminar in a week. Can we shoot a couple of pigeons over my dog? I said, sure. And all his dogs were called Tar, you know. And so we go up in the field, and I must admit I've had about enough of them, and I really enjoyed them, but we trained differently. And so I get a couple of good pigeons out of the pen, and I said, Richard, will this dog sit? Is he steady? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, when the bird gets up, will he sit? He said, of course he will. I'm just going to blow the sit whistle. You know, I said, well, has he had a bird on him yet? No, but I'll blow the sit whistle and he'll sit. So I said, okay, I'll fix this bugger. I got the wildest pigeon I could get, you know. He flushed it. He went a ways, and I shot it. I said, we'll see now. He'll be breaking. He blew that sit whistle, and the dog sat like that, you know. And you know what he taught me? Sit means sit. And if that dog, if you do your homework, boundaries and stuff like that, I'm a big guy of your homework, and sit means sit. They'll sit no matter what. They're chasing a car or a deer, or in this case, a bird. And I must say, I've learned quite a bit with him.
Well, you know, it's funny. I learn something every time I get in the same field with a dog. And even on our training day last weekend, I realized that 3/4 of what we are really teaching is obedience in one way, shape, or form. It's simply a matter of what are the cues to get the dog to obey whatever we want them to obey. And sometimes it's a flushing bird, sometimes it's a whistle, sometimes it's a verbal command, that sort of thing. Hey, let's drill down on the Cocker Spaniel thing, because there is, as you said, back in the day, there were actually some really good dual dogs that were doing the bench shows and the field work. And there's still a couple fans of the TV show who write me once in a while. They're big believers in the American Cocker, but take us a little further to school into some of the more prominent Cocker Spaniel variety / sub-breeds, if you will, that are becoming more and more popular here in the States.
Let me tell you something. This is my first time with you. You're really setting me up to, I got to start looking around who's walking behind me after I get through with this. Well, what my thoughts are. I'm playing with you. You know what? These hunt tests are coming along, and they're very nice. But, you know, I don't think the American, this is my opinion, I don't think the American Cocker will ever make it. You know, they don't have the drive and stuff that they used to have, number one. And the only way they're going to make it, and this is where people want to shoot me, is if we breed them to an English Cocker, you know, to get that drive. But once you lose your gene pool, I'm a big guy on genes, and you don't have that drive, you know. I really believe, this is one thing Dick Walters and I really talked a lot about, I don't believe in the 49-day program where you take the puppies at 49 days.
Yeah.
I think a soft puppy you can handle properly from that 49th day, you can make them into a special dog, and a hard-headed dog, you can do just the opposite. And I think it's all the time that is spent with these dogs in the beginning, how they turn out.
Well, do we bring them home sooner or later?
No, I have no problem with 49 days.
All right.
Days. It's what you do after you get them home.
Oh, I get it. And absolutely. In fact, I just wrote that line for a magazine story. You know, dogs never stop learning. They've been learning since they were born. They were learning in the womb, and they never stop.
I think the English Cockers were thinking, how can I screw Raymond Casho up after I get out of here? They're little buggers. But they are. We just had a litter. They were gone after 2 days on the ground, you know. And they are the dogs right now. You want to talk about other spaniels that I deal with, like the Boykins and stuff? Or you want to keep it with Cockers and English Cockers?
I want to focus a little bit more on that. But first off, that's a pretty big litter for a Cocker Spaniel, isn't it?
Six is a... about normal. They can have more, they can have less. I would say six is average.
Okay, you know? All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so define I guess I'll call it the conformational differences, and then the other stuff that you alluded to, the differences between, say, with, you know, the typical Lady and the Tramp Cocker Spaniel and say, a field-bred English Cocker.
Because of my background with my grandfather and working with Talbot Radcliffe a lot, you know, form should equal function. I really believe that. I also do a lot of time down in Florida in the wintertime working with some Hall of Fame horse trainers, and that is very important for them, form to equal function. And that's what my grandfather always said, and Talbot too, you know. If the form isn't there and the function, they'll break down, like a racehorse or even a dog if they're crooked in the front, you know, this and that. The problem with the American Cockers was, back when my grandfather won at Westminster, everybody wanted a Brucey puppy, and he flooded the market, and there was no other dogs to go to, you know. And I wish this was false, but I know it's true. You don't see too many dual champions anymore. You know, the American Cockers, when you see them in a show with all that hair, you could never, ever be able to hunt them, could you? You know, I think the Labradors, once in a while, you can get a show dog that works, but not much. Springers, same thing. Bench and feel like night and day.
But it's not just the hair, though. There's some conformational questions beyond that, aren't there? Differences, I mean.
I'm trying to be polite.
Yeah.
I'm a big guy on eyes, very big guy on eyes, with horses, people, and dogs. And I never had luck with a light-eyed dog. When you think about it, you know, the dogs that were kind of tough, the train, the Chessies, some of the other breeds, they have light eyes. And sometimes our Spaniels, because we're, well, in America, we don't have breeders anymore. I'm sorry. You breed the good to good and hope for the best. You know, there's no straight lines. Like, I worked with a lady, Ruth Greening, back in the 70s, and she was a breeder, and Talbot Radcliffe was a breeder. And, boy, you see it in our program now, in the Cockers and the Springers. The one thing we got going with us for the Cockers is we do a lot of imports. And the Brits won't put up with anything. You know, I spent some time over there. And if the dog doesn't make it, you don't see the dog again. I'm not even going to go into that. But so it's only good to good. The country you can drive one end to the other in 10 hours. So, you know, like you're out there and you call me, hey, Ray, I got a nice cocker. I want you to look really nice. Well, I don't know. I've never seen him hunt. I've never seen him in trials. It's your word, you know, going in. It's just, we got bad breeding out there, and people, and that's going to affect all our breeds. You know, I see the spaniels now, the English spaniels, running more like setters, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They're higher up in their legs. They're going harder. Their heads are up. And the cockers, I'm going to tell you another cute story about cockers. So when you think of dogs that trail well, I think of a beagle with rabbits, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Their head is closer to the ground, isn't it? You know? And when you see pointers work, and our spaniels now, they're higher up in the air looking for body scent, you know? These little cockers are down there. I had a bunch of pros come in before a national, and they came and trained with us. And my friend Dean Rinke had a black cocker called Cinder. And we were just doing all spaniels. And then at the end, it was a bad setting day. We weren't finding many birds at all. And so at the end, we took Cinder out. Now, this is after whole morning and half an afternoon. And these birds were just, we were very, very poor production day. And bird after bird, this little dog was putting up in the air, trailing and stuff like that. I think, and I hope, and that's what I tell the cocker people, I've judged their nationals and everything. If you keep running these dogs out in the field, you're not going to have cockers anymore. And judges today, they don't know the difference between a cocker and a spaniel.
Yeah,
you know, it's like night and day. You know, cockers are their busy as can be. Like I said, a hummingbird on crack. Their hiney's going one way, their head's going the other, their tail's going there. They're just like a bumblebee, never stopping. You know, and I gotta say, I'm a Springer man, but I'm switching to cockers. You know, because they're a little bit more difficult to train. I know that, but they're exciting to watch. You know.
Well, what is it about them that is more difficult to train versus even a Springer? I mean, a lot of people think they're interchangeable parts.
No way. Night and day. I mean, the cockers are spiteful little buggers. And any good trainer you talk to will tell you a story about a cocker where they mucked around with them. You know, a cocker that's trained by a good pro, you know, they still, every once in a while, flip you the bird, you know, and it's just the way they are. And they hold grudges. So if you get too heavy with them, which I don't think you should do with any dog, but they're going to quit on you.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll come out in the flush, it'll come out in the mouth, and I like them. I like to watch them. They're little buggers when you train them. You know, they want to jump in your arms when they don't have a bird in their mouth, but they want to drop the bird 3 or 4 feet from you, okay?
Got it, yeah.
You always got to work on that. And over at Palmview, I've never forced a dog in my life, okay? I don't know how to do it, and I've had good luck over the years by just doing it with good dog. I'm not a clicker trainer. The punishment fits the crime.
Yeah. And by forcing, you're talking about force fetching, retrieving.
Yeah,
am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, hey, let me remind everybody, that's Jerry Cascio, gun dog columnist and spaniel trainer extraordinaire. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. We're going to delve deeper into that, ask the darker side of Cocker Spaniels in a moment. And in fact, your last column in the magazine talked about how to use e-collars on Spaniels. And I'm eager to learn more. But first, something I've been intrigued with and have alluded to, and actually had the chance to make some episodes out in New York, out in your country, and you and I talked a few days ago about some of those, I guess I'll call them legacy hunt clubs back up the Hudson there. Tell us a little bit about that whole world. It's intriguing to us because we read about it back in the day when the magazines were all about that kind of stuff. What are some of your fondest recollections of some of those old school hunt clubs?
You're a bugger, Scott. You're a bugger. this is when I get preaching, you know.
Yeah.
I started in 1967, and everybody had a sports jacket on and a tie and worked their dog. They were ladies and they were gentlemen. And we've lost that, and it's so sad. And the smartest thing I did was I was born in the Hudson Valley. You know, we have my kennel within 15 to 20 minutes, one of them you went to. We've had great shooting clubs. One of my favorites is Clove Valley. And if I had the money to get in Clove Valley, I don't have the right breeding. And, you know, I used to get upset about that Italian from New York and this and that. But you know what? They had something beautiful, and they kept it that way. And my favorite word these days is mutts, the people and the dogs, you know. And
yeah.
I can see in our spend, you know, we'd have a banquet, you know. My first trial I ran in, a puppy, it was a Springer. And I looked to the right, I said, this guy, who is this guy? I know this guy. And it was Robert Montgomery shooting over our dogs. And then Dr. Milbank had a dog running, and one of the guns didn't have a tie on. Of course, there was a lot of money in the game. Then he came up to the gun, my friend Joe, actually, and he said, oh, Joe, you forgot your tie today. And he had the chauffeur say, look, we must have a tie in the car, very politely, but, you know, and he come out with a tie. And they just bred that, like the New York Yankees. You go to play the New York Yankees, I'm sorry, you better cut your hair, you know? And they had such a war. We went to these banquets, and the women were dressed. That was the only trial they kind of go to. It was a national banquet in gowns, you know, and food. It's just unbelievable. And
well, there's got to be something. I mean, I was struck when I visited Tamarack out there, which I learned quickly is it looks like a really old club, but it's really not. But it's in the style of it, and we had a wonderful time, and there's the others out there. Most of us have heard of Sandinona because it's an Orvis operation, but like you said, there's others out there. What do you think the legacy of those organizations is to the sport in general? I mean, what are they blessing us with even to this day?
I wish I could say something positive about that, but I can't. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Once you lose your dress code, you're talking to a man that's 76 years old now, okay? So bear with me. But when, you know, you lose your dress code, when you wear your pants down to your knees, and you don't respect the game, you leave it laying there instead of hanging it up. And I could go on and on and on. I don't think we'll ever get it back. And I almost got tears in my eyes now when I'm saying this. Because here's something I love more than anything else. I saw it done the right way. And now I also work for Purina, and I go to a lot of events. And it's heartbreaking for me. It really is. Dogs, they always used to be so groomed and well-kept.
Okay, so here's your chance, Jerry Cascio, to tell the rest of us, while some are not, many of us are younger than you, and we do believe in many of the same things I believe that you do. If we were to do one or two things differently to take us back at least a baby step toward that, you know, the glory days, if you will, what are the things that we should do?
Okay, well, I believe in dress code, okay? You don't have to be dressed in a tie. Well, some people still do. I guided at Meshomic up the road from where you were for 26 years. And most of those members, being a little bit older, you know, and respect for the game, I think, came dressed with a bow tie or a tie. What happens now, and I've experienced this, but, you know, I used to go out with Randolph first. I trained a pointer for him, one of a really, really gentleman, you know. And he just enjoyed the dog so much. You know, he knew about dogs. He spent a lot of time with Labradors in California and stuff. And his claim to fame is going out there and maybe getting lucky in his older years shooting a bird, you know. And now we got these, I call Wall Street mutts. I'm sorry. Probably nobody will listen to another one of your podcasts after me. But you know, they come up from Wall Street. They got so much money now. Having a good time is going to a tower shooting 50 or 100 birds, you know. And I remember I used to work for Mr. Daly up at Meshomic, and he would always ask them if they had a good time, and they'd chicken on me if I did a good job, you know. And it was funny. We had a great time. We shot 60 birds. And I remember Randolph Hearst coming in and saying, you know, Mr. Daly, I had a great time. My dog did wonderful, but your birds are too fast for me. I only hit one. Who had the better time, you know?
Yeah.
Go down to those old plantations. Everybody's shooting a side-by-side, dressed up properly. And that's why the Cockers are making a big hit, because it's more important that bird gets in the bag than just leave it laying there, you know? And I've seen too much of that in my life, even in our nationals. We don't take care of game. I worked over in England. You know, the game was very important because we got paid for that, you know. And so the bird couldn't be damaged. It had to be presented properly. Or the buyer would come back and say, look, I'm not going to pay it for 10 of these that were damaged. Well, that's why we have the rule of hard mouth, you know. It's such a touchy subject with me and the – you know, I get on a soapbox, so.
Well, I don't mind, but here's your chance to step off the soapbox for a couple minutes, take a break, get a drink of water, because I'm going to talk a little bit about some things that allow me to talk a lot. So Jerry Ray Caccio will be back with us in just a moment. In the meanwhile, the rest of you, take a look at your website, drtims.com. That's where you learn all about Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. It's my dog food of choice. I rotate through a couple formulations. Right now we're up in the protein and the fat content a little bit, going to what he calls his momentum mix. If you'd like to try it, you can get 30% off your first order. Just use the code UPLANDNATION. I've talked about this before, but you know all those other websites where you can order and have stuff delivered all the time? Well, Dr. Tim's will do that as well, so learn all about scheduling a regular delivery at drtims.com. And speaking of regular, I am a firm believer in regularly using my ear protection, whether it's in the field or on the range, as I was doing a few days back. And I got to confess, I forgot to get some new batteries for mine during our training day, but I was reminded of that by a good friend. If you'd like to learn more about the best hearing protection out there, go to espamerica.com. Electronic Shooter's Protection is what ESP stands for. My friend Jack Homa will arrange for you to be fitted locally. So in this, you know, era of no sportsman shows, which may be a good thing, because who wants to be the monkey in the cage getting fitted behind the counter when everybody walks by and points at you at a sportsman show? You can do it in the privacy of your own audiologist's office right there in town. Just go to the dealer locator page at espamerica.com. Find out all about all the ways and all the prices for ESP Electronic Shooter's Protection Hearing Protection Devices. All right, we're back. My name is Scott Linden. Appreciate your listening. Our guest this week on the Upland Nation podcast, Jerry Ray Caccio, gun dog columnist, former hunting guide, kennel owner, dog trainer. Man, oh man, you've got a long story to tell. That's the joy of podcasting, though. We are really not limited by much, and that's why I appreciate your being with us. Jerry, let's jump right in here. Your latest column for Gun Dog Magazine talks about e-collars and how we need to, as trainers of Cocker Spaniels in particular, we need to maybe shift our mind a little bit. Why don't you explain the thesis of your article?
Yeah, it's, I actually work seminars, and some good friends work with Garmin, and I still work with them, even though my beliefs and my stories sometimes are very negative about a collar, an e-collar, no matter what brand. And here's my thoughts, and I've seen it over the years, and it's sad, is that at Palmview, yeah, we've got collars and stuff, but we don't start out using collars, okay? A lot of the lab trainers that I work with that are very good, and I can't say much about the e-collars with labs because they're a different breed, and I don't train them at that level that these guys do. But let's talk about cockers. My thoughts, okay, I actually know I'm right. It's something I feel very strong with. I don't think you should be allowed. Now, you're going to learn over the next month. Jerry Cash is just out in space in a lot of things. You know, I'm in dream world sometimes. And it just, these collars, I think you should have to go to school, you know, like get your driver's license, you know, before you use them. I've seen so many people with collars ruining a dog. If I make a mistake in training, I don't ruin a dog. Because we don't use a collar only for a couple things, which I'll go into. But, you know, we roll in a lot of birds, and that's how we teach them to quarter and stuff like that. We use 200 birds a week in training, okay? It's the most expensive part of our game, but, you know, birds make it happen. I don't think I'm a dummy trainer or this or that. I want the real thing. And I've seen people try to do quick fixes, Band-Aid fixes. And then the dog usually has to have a collar almost the rest of his life. And I'm going to tell you a story that just happened 2 weeks ago. A friend of mine bought a black cocker. And he came, and the dog was trained and everything. He paid good money for the dog. The dog wouldn't flush a pigeon, would circle it and this and that. And, you know, he was supposed to be steady. He was steady once the bird got up. So I said to him, I said, Bob, do you mind if we take the collar off the dog? You know? And we did, and now this will be the third week that he's a different dog, okay? Now, the problem is with that, the handler has to be on top of the dog a little bit more, and you got to know how to read the dog and stuff like that. But over my years, my opinion, the collar is ruined more dogs than it's ever trained, okay?
Well, so tell me, what is the biggest mistake we make with an electric collar?
Because you do quick fixes. You don't do the boundary work, you know, the yard work, or sit means sit, no matter what. A good friend Ian Openshaw taught me this one. Get your dog to walk to heel without a collar, right? Walk to heel, give them the sit whistle, and keep walking. 90% of your dogs will keep walking with you, you know?
Sure.
So they're not trained, are they? You know? So, you know, if the collar takes the excitement away from the dog, okay, he smells the bird, he's worried about that shock, okay, and he slows down. And I've seen it so many times. And just because people are lazy, you know, they just, you know, I always say our field trial dogs, okay, we never run them in braces or anything. And everybody, you know, oh, blah, 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 well, I had two national champions, and I'm in the Hall of Fame. I guess I must be doing something right, you know? And it's just positive reinforcement. And I don't go to second grade till I got first grade down perfect. And our field that we train, they're not where you want to go hunting or anything like that. I call them training fields, you know? And and it's a schooling field, and the dogs know they have to behave there. And I think the collar is a quick fix, and it's just not used properly. What we'll use a collar for, we'll get most of our dogs won't come into us until they have real problems or they're 8 months old. So the biggest issue we have is, okay, they pick up a bird and run around with it and stuff, or a dummy or a ball, they don't come. Well, we got to give them a retrieve deal. Well, he's retrieving, he's just not coming. So we'll use, are you familiar with the come command with the collar? And that we'll use that a lot in the beginning if we can't get it through the dog's head our way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we use it right at the end when we're steadying the dog and we've got them what we call 95% steady. We might hold them a little bit longer and nick them.
Yeah.
Okay. And that seems to work.
Let's go back to that first one, that recall, because various trainers use the collar in various ways. We got a dog out somewhere out there, whether they have a bird in their mouth or not is probably immaterial. How are you using the collar after the dog knows what the command means? And that maybe we need to use a disclaimer here and tell everybody the dog doesn't learn these commands from the collar. He learns them from the human being and all those other techniques, whether it's a check cord or anything else, yard training. All right. So once we're there, how do you use the collar to get your dog back to you?
Okay. We do it in the yard.
Yeah.
Okay? We do a lot of work in the yard. We'll put a check cord on a dog. I'll be working the collar. Danny will be holding the dog. Well, about here's what I think we do right. Our distances are always close.
Yeah.
So let's say this come command is probably 10 feet in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have control of the dog at 10 feet. If I go to 30 feet, I have less. I go to 50, oh, forget it. So we teach at small distances. That said, 10 feet. So I'll say, come, low stimulation, continuous. I keep the button down until he gets halfway. I have the check cord, so if he wants to bolt one way or another, I can get him into me. When he gets about halfway, I let up. And hopefully the dog learns how to shut the stimulation off.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
The secret is that if a dog is screaming or trying to bolt from the cord, I got the level up too high. And I when I do my collar seminars, I say it's like a stove, okay? If you got a stove that's red hot, for whatever reason, man, you touch it and you jump back, okay? And you want no part of that stove, you know? If it's just a warmer on or something like that, you investigate, don't you? Hey, what did I leave on? Did I leave the pilot light on? Did I do this or that? But it's got you thinking. And I want this dog to learn that, hey, the quicker you come in, we use a lot of treats also.
Sure.
The quicker he comes in, he gets that reward. I say, this probably saves us a week. You know, by using the collar there.
Yeah.
So that's what we, most of it, and then like I said, steadiness at the end, you know. But we do our basic, we just, we never run our dogs in brace work. So I said that, you know, and then these people go to a trial and, I haven't run a brace. I said, you know, if he knows turn, he knows sit, you don't need anything else. The problem is he probably doesn't know those whistles. You know?
Sure.
And we've had a lot of success. Danny, who runs the dogs in field trials now, you know, we had a second high dog last year. But they know turn, they know sit. You know, the more you make a fuss over a problem, it becomes a major problem. You know, you're better off to say, hey, let me quit today. Let me try to think, what did I do wrong? Every single time, it's something you did wrong in your training. And we got to say that's got to be 99% of the time. You know?
So the best, possibly the best use of an e-collar would be to put it on the trainer.
I try that sometimes. I said, you know, and you know what got me is, and I saw it when I was guiding a lot. They would miss a bird, and they would hit the dog with a collar. You know, it was the dog's fault that they missed the bird. You know, I said over the years, I think so.
Oh my!
Oh, and you know what? What do? We go eat at McDonald's. We go eat here. We're a society now where everything has to be done in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you never get a fully trained dog that way. You know?
No. Patience really is still a virtue, isn't it, Jerry?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And okay. Just some kind of repetition.
Okay. I'm going to get selfish for a minute here because I've never trained a spaniel, and I've read a lot about it, and even the pointing dogs I've trained, I've never trained extremely well, but how do you get that dog to really, I mean, what I love to see in the field is a spaniel that crashes in on the bird and flies that bird as if it's the last bird in the world and he wants to get it so badly. Is there some way to encourage that kind of a flush?
Well, of course. You know, the one thing is you want to get your breeding right, you know. Oh, he wants $1,000 for a puppy. I can get one for $800. Well, you get that one for $800, you're going to spend another $5,000 with him, you know. So get your breeding right, you know, and that's easy to do. That part's easy. And what makes us so good and famous is because we use 200 pigeons a week. You know, 200 pigeons a week. Those dogs, that's what they live for. You
sure.
know?
Yeah.
And that develops a drive, and they have no fear of good question. They have no fear of flushing that bird because they're not going to get hit with a collie.
Yeah.
We had a guy up today with a lab, and he wanted the lab to point. And this drives me crazy, too. If you want a pointer, get a pointer. If you want a flusher, get a flusher. But all you do is put the collar on it, and you hit them heavy. And he blames it on the bird, doesn't he? What's he? He says, "Wow, I don't like flushing this bird. I get hit with a cow. Guess what? You got a pointer.
It's in a day. We don't think literally. The dogs think literally. We don't. So we're going two steps beyond. I get that completely.
Right.
Tell me what we can do. So we've got young pointers. We're out on Saturday morning, and we're putting pigeons out for the pointers. And a good Cocker Spaniel trainer is going to put those pigeons out in a way that bird will freak out and fly when it sees or hears that bird, that dog coming in. Unfortunately, we dizzy those birds so hard, or we sleep them, or whatever else you want to call it, and the dog catches the bird. How do you do it differently?
Good question again. We don't plant any birds. Now, let me tell you this. Right now, I've trained one pointing dog in my life. Okay, and that was from Randolph First. You know, I know what you're talking about and stuff like that, but I'm not a pointing dog trainer. But what we do is we call, are you familiar, like roll the bird in? When we get a dog, he wants to range, you know, especially the first couple of times. Well, if he ranges out there, I stop a lot of my students, say, okay, stop, you know, I got to say it three times to them, they're just like the dog. And I said, stop, when they're getting nervous, I'm going to yell at them or something like that. I said, what's this dog thinking right now? And you get the stupid look, you know, they're not dog trainers, they're just, you know, people that make a living doing something else.
Silly humans.
And so I said, what the dog's thinking is the birds he finds are way out there. The kiss of death is for a spaniel to find a bird out of range.
Yeah.
Then you got to go back to a collar or something. What we do, stop me if you're not familiar with my terms. We roll in birds and we use pigeons, okay? So that dog is out. In the beginning, they're always what I call virtually out of range, okay?
All right.
So we throw a bird in front of us, in front of the handler. Even if they see it, we don't care. But we give them what we call a crazy whistle. It's kind of a turn whistle, but just a lot of noise.
Yeah, yeah.
Within 3 days, what's that dog thinking? You know, that crazy whistle, I don't know what it means or anything, but if I get my honey back to Raymond, I'm going to find a bird, you know, and that's what I'm out here for.
Okay.
All our dogs run figure eight patterns, you know, which is if you sit down and draw a diagram, a figure eight pattern is the best pattern for every wing condition, you know.
Yep.
It gives the dog the right opportunity to smell that bird and go in. So there's no fear about flushing. They got no respect for their body, and they got a full choke nose. And like you said, it's something for people that haven't seen it. Come on into New York or somebody with a good spaniel dog, and it puts goosebumps all over you. Now they can go 90 miles an hour up in the air and come down and sit. A pointer, that's what they're bred to do, point. Our dogs are bred to flush it again, flush it until it gets tired and eat it, you know?
The hair is standing up on the back of my neck. I'm just loving this idea. So the takeaway for us is, if you're working with a flushing dog, you're planting those birds and bringing the dog ideally right back to it. So the bird doesn't have to stay still for very long. You say roll the bird in, but I don't think you're really literally rolling it. You're just throwing it into some cover of some sort. Does that sound right?
We'd try not to throw it in cover. And so the dog's out there too far. I give them that crazy whistle. I want the dog to smell it and then see it. Our cover's not very, very heavy.
Yeah.
For a reason. Because then he's using his eyes, isn't he, too? His nose, his eyes. And that really makes him go in even harder.
Yeah,
If you plant a bird and God forbid a dog hears it or, you know, they'll start looking with their eyes and bouncing around, not really driving with their nose, you know.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, the only way to do it is, you know, 200 birds a week.
You're not any different than all the pointer trainers I've talked to, who will advocate that without birds, you got no bird dog. It doesn't matter what kind, even the stubby-legged ones. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Jerry Ray Cascio, gun dog columnist, hunting guide in the day, Pondview Kennels founder, seminar leader, consultant to Orvis and Purina and even Garmin once in a while. This guy knows his spaniels. So, Jerry, everybody wants to pair their pointing dog with a flushing dog. And I know we could spend another hour and a half just talking about that, but if there's one thing that you could tell us to do, besides we're crazy.
Yeah, no, you're not crazy at all. And like I said, I spent a lot of time in some big Orvis lodges down south. And what we got them to do eventually is, I'm not a pointing dog trainer. I already established that already.
Yeah.
If you let the pointing dogs go in and flush, if you let them take those extra steps, you got a springer.
Yeah.
So what we did down there was, okay, the pointers went on point. We clip a lead on them, put them back in the wagon, and we bring a cocker down to do the flush. A couple of things now. Remember, and it's a sad thing, a lot of dogs and people have been shot down south with these quail. If you're unfortunate enough not to go where there's a wild quail, there's not too many places with wild quail, they could get up and down quick, you know, and a dog could be shot, a person could be shot. And when you go to these places, they always show you a film first about safety, but as soon as the people get in the wagon, they forget about safety. But that cocker going in there and flushing that bird, we said this before, it's going to get up. Even if the pen-raised bird's going to get up quicker, higher, and faster. If the guy goes in there with a flushing whip or something like that, it's not going to scare the bird that much. So really, I think it works good in both cases. The cockers can have their fun of retrieving and working hard, and the pointers become better pointers.
You sound like you're in the training world, in the training phase, if you will. You're actually picking up those pointers and taking them out of the transaction after the point. At some point, at least if we believe all the magazine photos, the poor pointing dog has to stand there and watch the cocker blow by him and get all the fun. Is there an interim step there? Are we putting that check cord on, or what are we doing?
Well, you know, to me, I don't think me especially can train a pointer that well. You know, I get a chance to spend with Ronnie Smith down in Texas every year, and he's got wild quail, and the dogs really end up training themselves. But he doesn't mix apples and oranges. And I don't know this for a fact, but some of these pictures you see of the dog, I wonder if they're two separate shots that they mesh together or something. You know, because it's apples and oranges. And every time I do apples and oranges, I get in trouble.
I get it. So let's go to somebody who's you know, maybe trying to get to the next level, or maybe it's their first dog. What are some of the most helpful, useful tools and gear that they should have with them when they're training their dog?
Well, of course, all Orvis equipment. here's a question I ask people. Okay, Scott, you're on an island, and you can only bring two things with you. You got plenty of birds out there, but you can only bring two things with you. And my first choice is a check cord.
Yeah.
It's not an electric collar.
Yep.
And, you know, people don't want to spend time with their dogs when they're young, you know, especially if they know they're going to send it to a trainer, you know. I want sit to mean sit before he gets his food, sit before you throw a ball. Come when he's called, not just when it's dinner time. And if you do all that stuff right, and Scott, you know dogs, what's it take you? 15 minutes? The one thing, the worst thing with dogs, if you do one more time. You know, they've done it three times right, quit, you know? And I believe, and I know I'm right on this one, is, you know, repetition, positive repetition, you know?
Yeah, but don't be
punishment fits the crime.
Yeah, and don't be a greedy owner. That three rule of three. Yeah. I've turned it back to two, and I've trained a few of the guys in our club to go to two, and now they're reminding me because I just want one more as well.
Yeah. Well, sometimes good trainers want to show off a little bit.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah. That's like I said, greedy owners.
So
of all the commands that a Cocker Spaniel owner and by you know, default, probably all flushing dog owners, we have one training command that I think is very obvious from our discussion, and that would be sit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What would the next one be? Come?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
And then the third one would be when you actually get down there ready to go out in the field.
Yeah.
And that's when we start rolling the birds in, and you know, they got to stay within gun range. So important, isn't it, that especially a flushing dog, you know. I know when you get old, your age, you need a pointer so you can go up there and get close to them before the shot.
Don't get me started on that argument.
And, you've got to have them close, you know, and I don't care what kind of shot you are. When they're starting to get over 30 yards, it's 50-50, you know?
Yeah, in fact, what would you consider to be an appropriate range for most gunners and most Spaniels? How far out do you want that dog actually to really be?
Well, if you ask any of my students, they're going to say 29 feet. 29 feet. I yell that at them because here's what I want, and it's so perfect to do, is if you shoot the birds at 29 yards, and you're more apt to hit them, you're more apt to miss one once in a while, and you hit it with your second shot, so they get a little bit longer, or they got to trail a rooster, okay?
Yeah.
But if most of your shots at 29 yards, you're building the dog's confidence up.
Yeah.
And You know, it's like shooting, and I'm having a hard time the last 3 days. I went to these new shells, one ounces, and blah blah blah, and I haven't missed a bird since I've been back home. I'm a good shot, but I'm not that good. I missed two the other day, and I bet you I missed 10 since then in 4 days. You know, it's all a confidence thing. You know,
yeah.
I'm dead. I missed one. I must be stopping the gun. I must be looking over. And all this shit goes through your head. Golfers know it better than us dog trainers. But it's just, you know, I first started out with Palm View. Had a lot of trees and stuff, so we couldn't get long retrieves. I go to a field trial, and these guys are gunners, and they're out there 20 yards from the dog.
Yeah.
And I'm getting these 50-yard retrieves. My dog will never do that. And I go, Alex, and boom,
well,
boom.
Well,
I'm just confident.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of our favorite guests on my TV show is Al Gadori, 6X Outfitters in Montana. Al, number one, he's brilliant. He's got all sorts of great knowledge for us in all sorts of areas. But number two, he's a deadeye. This guy, he's the go-to. You know, in the music business, we had in L.A., in the studio world, we had you were a first call player. So they would schedule recording sessions around your schedule, not the other way around. Al's a first call gunner for spaniel tests. What does it take to be a great spaniel test gunner?
Oh, boy, another bad question. What we've done over the last maybe 10 years, I'll say, the AKC has got involved in our shooting and our judging and stuff like that. So you can go to a gunning seminar, and you pass that seminar, and you're a gun. Now, in the old days, you were only asked to shoot if a pro recommended it or you were seen in action. You just didn't pass a test, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yep.
And today, I think the gunning has been the worst I've ever seen it. And I think the judging, the same thing. We got judging seminars that have not helped our judging at all.
Well, but
you know, we don't have many people that hunt anymore, Scott. Well, I mean, I know that.
You know, yeah.
And they don't know how to read dogs. And sometimes, I'm sure you've seen this. You hit a pheasant in the head. You know, it comes down. It looks like it's stone dead. The dog goes out to the mark, and the bird gets up and thinks, oh, that's a different bird. I'm sure it was shot. Well, you've never hunted then, buddy, my friend, you know, because hunters will see it all the time. Or you hit a bird in the wing, and it rolls, it goes down, and it's got legs. Oh, no, I'm sure I killed it.
Yeah, hey, sure. That's my line, you know. but you guys in the spaniel world, you actually want those birds to get up and get out of there, and you do want a guy like Al to drop those birds at 50 yards, don't you?
Yeah, not 50. I think sometimes 50 happens if they miss
them. Yeah.
It might be 50 yards from the dog because we have guns on both sides of the handler. So they're at about 20 yards. If they shoot at 30, it ends up being 50, you know?
And why is that? Why do you want those long retrieves?
Well, we got to separate them, don't we?
Yeah.
We got to separate the dogs, you know? And some dogs make them and some dogs don't. You know,
yeah.
It's when you're judging, another thing I'm very proud of, I've judged more trials than anybody in America, flushing dogs. And that's because I'm old, number one. and I do a good job, I must say. But, you know, it's a total package, isn't it? I'm sure you see this with the pointers. You know, it's all about he won it because he did a 60-yard retrieve. Wait a minute. What did he do before that? Was a 60-yard retrieve because the dog was out there 50 yards? You know, it's a total package, and people get memorized by just certain one piece of the whole performance.
Yeah.
And the only way you do it is by getting experience and calling a spade a spade. You know, if we get a bad gun or a bad judge, let's not ask them to shoot or gun anymore, you know?
Oh, I remember well the first field trial I ever went to. I was just a spectator, but the poor gunners were the best shots from the trap club.
Yeah.
And they couldn't hit a pen-raised chucker to save their lives. And eventually, members of the organizing club went out there and kind of fired them.
And,
And I think about that every time somebody asks me to gun, but that's another story. All right, we're getting towards the end of your segment, Jerry Ray Cascio, Gun Dog magazine columnist. So tell us one thing about you that we don't know.
Oh my God! You know what? I don't. You can cut this out if you out of the podcast. If you want, we'll come up with something else. I get very emotional now at my age. I am a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober 33 years. The first year I was sober, I won a national. The second year I judged. The third year I won another national with another dog. And so I've had a very bumpy road. I say to people, well, you know this guy? No, but I can tell you if he's a good trainer, if he's been married a lot and he's an alcoholic. You know, it seems like a trainer. Kind of, you know, I don't, you can cut that out if you want.
No, but that is so true, though.
I'm very proud of those.
Well, and congratulations. I not from personal experience, but from very close friends, I know how hard that is. So good on you for a 33-year pin or coin. I'm not sure which it is way out there, but good on you. And thank you for sharing that. Hopefully it'll be a lesson for a lot of other people as well. And you're right. You know, when we're shopping for a trainer or a hunting buddy or something like that, there are outward appearances that might be worth taking a closer look at. Jerry Ray Cascio, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I'd love to come out and see your country again. I had a great time the first I was out there, and looking forward to
it. You were so close. Yeah. Well, you never know.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope we can do it again. Thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
I enjoyed it myself. You asked very good questions.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too, sir. Bye-bye.
Our This Land Is Your Land feature is coming right up. I'm going to challenge you in that our wild bird / public access walk-in hunting segment. So get ready for a little bit of a kind of a pop quiz. But in the meanwhile, let me remind you that we're brought to you in part by Gunner Kennels, gunner.com. If you didn't listen to Addison Edmonds' visit to our Upland Nation podcast a couple weeks ago, please go back into the archives, if you will, and find out how he feels about Man's Best Kennel. 1,200 five-star reviews. One of the fun things to do at gunner.com is take the Fit Finder quiz or try the augmented reality app. Yeah, very few times are you able to actually remotely put your dog and your kennel in the same general location and see how everything works out. You can even crowdsource your fit. Watch some of the videos and learn why Gunner Kennels are truly man's best kennels. And then go over to dogtra.com, learn more about the TNB Duel and all their other stuff. Get the coupon code right here, SLUN10. That'll give you 10% off any purchase over $200 and free shipping on anything over $200 as well. What I like about, well, I've told you all about all the things I love about that TNB Duel. It is two collars, one controller, two sets of buttons. You know all of that, but here's another thing. Instead of a beeper on the top and the rest of the gear, including the battery on the bottom of that collar, so there's two big black boxes, they've skinnied it down to one. So the beeper horn is down below the dog along with everything else, so it's not blowing off right in his ears, the poor guy. Yeah, it is one small step for man and one giant leap for dogdom. Hopefully your dog will not be as distracted and he won't go deaf. So learn more at dogtra.com. This Land Is Your Land, brought to you by findbirdhuntingspots.com. Usually, I tip you to a place I've been that I think can stand a little bit more traffic among the ethical hunters who understand that there are many aspects to hunting, including but not limited to killing a limit. pardon the pun. This time, a little bit different. I want to challenge you. I was reminded of this not a few days ago. I was visiting a irrigation overflow pond. You know, out here in the West, the irrigation districts have these ditches, canals, whatever you want to call them. And at some point, everybody's taking their water out. The canal has to dump the rest of that water somewhere. So they make a low spot and it ends up there. And in a good year, we get to go out there and train our dogs, both in water work and then all the other stuff. Okay, so enough about that. I'm challenging you to find a spot like I found last week. A hunting spot within 50 miles of home. Public, wild birds, walk in or some other way for you to access it. But considering all of the limitations we may be faced with, whether they're practical, political, or health, public health oriented, 50-mile trip is probably worth taking a look at this season. Mine, knock wood, is about 11 miles from my place. And you know what I found there? I found a field full of Canada thistle. Say that three times fast. Canada thistle. That every time I walked through it or drove past it, boosted at least 10 and sometimes 50 mourning doves. I'd forgotten those little tiny seeds in those ugly, sticky thistles at the top of those stalks are full. They're just all over the ground out there. So my challenge to you is take a look at your map, pull out your online app if you choose to do it that way, whatever it is, find a publicly accessible spot within 50 miles and make me a semi-promise. I know life is complicated, but promise me you'll at least get serious about thinking about going there this season. Thank you, and good luck. This Land Is Your Land is also brought to you by HuntHuronSD.com. Huron, South Dakota, where the pheasants outnumber the people. That's why I go there. And ESPAmerica.com. Learn more about the range of prices and capabilities in their digital hearing protection. It's all at ESPAmerica.com. Well, I don't know about you, but I sure learned a lot about spaniels, spaniel training, the differences between them, and more, thanks to Jerry Ray Cascio, gun dog columnist, among other things. Thank you again, Jerry, for being a part of the program. Thank you all for listening to the Upland Nation podcast. In between podcasts, we correspond at the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page and the Upland Nation Facebook page. Do me a big favor. It's wacky, it's crazy, and anybody can say anything, but I hope you'll say something nice about the Upland Nation podcast when you review it wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, all of the above. Would appreciate your help there. Now's the time to start assembling your field first aid kit for you and your dog. And remember this, the times may be crazy, but it's still a good time to keep your friends close, your family closer, and your dog the closest. I hope you're having a great preseason season and looking forward to seeing you in the field. Thanks a lot.